Hello to everyone. I am in Minnesota visiting family. I wanted to come via the cloud and give you a talk anyway, because I'm going to be going on sabbatical in August. So it seemed like I was going to be AWOL for a little bit too long if I didn't come join you. And seeing as I'm visiting family, I figured I would give a talk on the Dharma of family. So just to check, everybody can hear me fine. And okay. So when I say the Dharma of family, this is not just about how do we apply our practice to family or in family, right? We have our practice, however you want to define that, zazen and study and precepts and various things. And then we think, when we're with family, how can we apply some of that, right? Keep precepts, be kind, have a bodhisattva spirit. And that's obviously an important thing to consider. But more what I'm talking about today is if you use the word dharma as like truth or teaching, then like what is the teaching of family, right? Like what can we learn about the dharma, about reality with a capital R through our family relationships? So today I'm going to offer a few suggestions. This is not by any means an exhaustive list. So I think I have four different kind of suggested dharmas of family, and I'll kind of pause after each one and we can discuss it a little bit. And if people think of other things you have learned, and in a way this is I mean, anything applies when we start to talk, but you might want to think about differentiating between kind of the how of practice, how to apply it, and more this insight into the true nature of self and reality. So how do our family relationships, give us more insight into the true nature of self and reality, as opposed to the how, which is kind of infinite, right? How do you best communicate with people? How do you work on your patience? How do you behave in a harmonious bodhisattva way with your family? So that's a big issue in and of itself, but this is more like what you can really learn through those relationships. So the first one I was going to start with was I'm calling it karma and rebirth. So the rebirth of the karmic self. So in Buddhist cosmology, mythology, if you will, which some Buddhists literally believe, but I don't, and I don't think you have to literally believe it. Is that we have multiple lifetimes, and that karma, the law of behavioral cause and effect, is what caused us to be born in this world. Something unresolved caused us to be reborn in this life, and then in this life we often generate more karma, right? By indulging anger or greed or delusion or negative habits or whatever, we generate some more unresolved stuff, which then will cause us to be reborn again. And that in this Buddhist cosmology model, the goal of spiritual practice, which it is not the Zen view, but the goal of spiritual practice is to kind of cleanse your karma, right? To resolve it and cleanse it so that you aren't reborn based on this unresolved stuff. And if you want to think about it as a kind of a beautiful myth or a beautiful mythology, not in the sense of like discounting it as, you know, definitely not true or something, but just the truth of it, the value of it isn't in the literalness of it. So if you want to, you know, really explore this imagery, one of the things like the Tibetans who practice and then they are reborn as lamas, you know, the like the Dalai Lama is a rebirth of some past teacher. So the way that they tell it is that if you have done enough practice and then you go into this, you know, this middle stage between lives, that you aren't compelled to be reborn, you choose to be reborn. Right? You choose to be reborn in order to teach others and to be of benefit. So I kind of like that as a, you know, imagery. Like we, when we reach the end of our life, we hope there's a minimum number of like compulsions and unresolved things left in our lives that will just kind of carry on after we die, one way or another. And hopefully just, you know, have things more at peace. So, you know, putting aside that whole question about multiple lifetimes, this teaching and this imagery can also be thought of within one lifetime. So we can observe the quote unquote rebirth of a self. And I think the most classic example of this, and I realize some of you out there may not have living parents anymore, but when you did, being around your parents like causes a rebirth of a child, you know? And maybe your par maybe the parents don't act like they usually do, but then when they're around their child, then this you know, this rebirth of the parent comes about. So obviously that's, you know, this rebirth isn't limited to just that one dynamic, but it's a pretty classic one. So we have, you know, relationships with, you know, siblings and children and parents and aunts and uncles and cousins and other people who are, you know, as close as family. And usually over the years, there's been complicated dynamics of one sense or another with people. We have a history with people. And so that's one of the things that actually makes practice challenging sometimes when practice really starts to change us, but we are still surrounded by the same people and they keep relating to us as that kind of that previous self. And then it's harder for us to break out of our habits because the people around us are relating to us as if, you know, we're kind of still the same reactive person, or maybe the person who, you know, loved to bitch about other people and gossip or whatever. So, yeah. So when we feel these karmic selves that we have, you know, many, it's not just one self, right? Kind of, when we feel these karmic selves reborn, and that usually feels very uncomfortable and frustrating, right? Well, you don't really identify with this, or maybe then we do, and then we wonder, like, wait a second, I thought I was over that, but suddenly now I care. Suddenly now I can't stand the way that my, you know, aunt seems to criticize me, right? It's just like, ah, all this insecurity is suddenly born. Where was it, right? Yesterday you were fine. Now you're around this person and suddenly you're, you know, feeling insecure. So when those things happen, can we recognize what is happening and leap beyond blame of self or other? So this is that karma verse that we recite before chanting service on Sundays. Born from beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, you know, somewhere this karmic stream arose, and it's continued through my own body, speech, and mind, and through the body, speech, and mind of others. And I'm just going to take responsibility for it now without blaming self or other. And when I'm thinking about taking responsibility for this karmic self, recognizing what's happening, I'm talking about what's happening within us, not the dynamics of the relationship. Right. So in particular, right now, I'm talking about the insights that we get from these situations, not whether we're able to make a relationship more peaceful or anything like that. So our thoughts, emotions, motivations, speech, behaviors. And you might think there's two approaches to this karma, which is the result of these past behaviors and choices by ourselves and others, is recognizing it. Oh, here I am getting pulled into a karmic pattern again. Or here is a past self arising in all its glory, compelling, emotional, very identified with our sense of well-being. And then recognizing it for the not self process that it is, disidentifying with it. So this is the Dharma teaching of anatta or not self. And in the classic Buddhist teachings, it doesn't talk about, well, your real self is this thing, that's not self. The entire practice is not self, not self, not self, not self, not identifying with anything. Because when we start to identify with things, that's when the delusion starts to arise. So disidentifying with it. And I think, it depends how easy that is. Depends a lot on your proximity to the person or people who encourage this self to arise, your relationships with them. Is it a relatively harmonious one? Because even relatively harmonious ones can still cause this kind of stuff to arise. But if it's a difficult, fraught relationship, then certainly it can be very difficult. Do we see this person, these people a lot? Do we live near them? Do we have regular interactions with them? Have they hurt us in the past? Have we hurt them in the past? So the Dharma, like the Dharma gate here, is an opportunity to use our family relationships to get insight into the not self nature of the karmic self, our ungraspable empty nature. When we identify with it, we suffer. When we disidentify with it, we take responsibility for our own karma, we feel relief and freedom. So, I will, before I go on to another Dharma gate, anybody have anything to say about your experience of ex these this self and this karma arising in response to human family relationships in particular, and identifying with that, releasing that, working through that. Susan. Are you still muted?
Sorry. Thank you. This is wonderful. Especially as I'm getting older. What it brought to mind is I spent a lot of time with my mom in her the last 15 years of her life, and she had gotten over the circumstances of her earlier life, and I began to see maybe how she was as a young person,
Hmm.
and it was clear to see how she sort of resembled her parents, and I could see quite a bit more than ever how many habits and little quirks I have that are like her. And it made it clear that kind of the way I am isn't a wonderful thing about me. It's just people. It's how people are. You act like your parents and they act like their parents, and it's just, oh gosh, aren't we this wonderful ball of reactions and cute things and difficulties? So that really came out from this relationship with her.
Hey, just take the chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Tommy. You're just talking about something I'm going through right now. I have two adult boys, and they are now in my house. They just come visit me, and I love them, and I think they love me too. So, but we live very different lifestyle. We have philosophically, we're thinking differently. We drive different cars. So basically, I'm learning. I felt like Buddhism really helped me to deal with the differences. So we share funds, and I try and avoid topics. Man, we got into some discussions, which is a little difficult, but I kind of appreciate the differences and try to learn how to live with the differences. Thank you for the topic.
Thank you. Yeah, it is very the elaborate stories that we tell about ourselves, and the people around us, and we're better than that, or we're not better than that. So much of the time, our being is a reaction to other people's karma. I'm not going to be like that. My sister and I are always like, just we have to be on time because my parents never were.
Yeah.
So now. All right. Well, I will move on to a big one. Forgiveness, recognizing and releasing dukkha. So, I don't even, as I'll talk about, I don't really necessarily even like the word forgiveness. It seems to imply a little more than we mean in the context of practice, right? Forgiveness to me, and if somebody's, I feel hurt by somebody, forgiveness to me, it sounds like I have a dialogue with this person and I say, I forgive you. And they probably say, well, screw you, but like it seems like it should be a dialogue or something, but I don't think that's necessarily the case, right? But that's, for me, that's the baggage that comes along, is that it implies water under the bridge and I'll just pretend it didn't happen. So that's not what I mean, but I think it's a valuable word still, so I'm keeping it around for the moment. So inevitably we hurt one another. Some things are obviously egregious. Boundaries need to be drawn. Sometimes relationships need to be ended. And all that is difficult. But most of the time, the hurts are much, much more subtle. It's about an omission. Like, you never did this thing to me, or said this thing to me, or made a priority of our relationship, or various things like that. And yet, those subtle things, somebody being a little too judgmental, or favoring one family member over another or whatever can really hurt and rankle as much as, any physical injury. So that's the forgiveness or the releasing of dukkha we're talking about has nothing to do with the other person. It's not about condoning or minimizing what they did or are doing. It's not about adopting an internal lie that says, yeah, you weren't really hurt. You can't be hurt. It's not about pretending things didn't happen or about embracing someone with a great warmth and acceptance you don't actually feel. So what we are doing is looking within and finding that resentment, that anger, that disappointment, that stress, and then really asking ourselves, why are we holding on to it? And the answer probably is, I mean, if you're anything like me, there's like because of the situation. I'm holding on to this because this person did this thing to me, or they continue to act like this. So that's, I have this internal situation because of their action. So unless that person changes, or they apologize, or recognize what they did, or something, then we can't have the internal peace. And again, I'm not talking about current threats or, where boundaries are necessary. So this is all internal work. It may have external ramifications. Once there's an internal shift, it may indeed shift our relationships, but that's not the main point. So internally, I'll share a teaching, which many of you, most of you will have heard by the Buddha. This is from the Dhammapada. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. He abused me, attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those carrying on like this, hatred does not end. She abused me, attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those not carrying on like this, hatred ends. So I think it's kind of funny language, carrying on. Like you're carrying on, you're not carrying on. But not carrying on, it really is this that simple. Not easy, but it is that simple. Because it's not about arguing with ourselves, which I think, most of us do, right? When we notice there's some emotional, mental thing that we're experiencing, and we're like, oh, that's negative. That's not something a good Buddhist should hang on to. So I should let that go. It shouldn't bother me. I should let it go. But generally, that's not very effective, right? We're arguing with ourselves. We're fighting with ourselves. Stop being upset, but there's another part of it that's like, what are you talking about, not being upset? This thing happened. So it's not about fighting ourselves. It's a thing that we discover through practice, right? We have to meditate and study and be mindful, learn to be more aware of our own internal processes until I like to describe it as like you're wandering around in your own mind, And you know that you're finding various things. And then one day you just kind of happen upon this little switch. And then you're like, what happens when I do this? And then you just do something like let go of an idea. You just stop carrying on. And it's not that, you stuff doesn't come back. I mean, you might have to find that switch again and throw it on a regular basis. But you know what it feels like to just, think of a situation like this, for example, where, you have some hurt feelings of disappointments in relationships, and to just let go of that story. Let go of that sense that this is the way things should be. This shouldn't have happened. This person should be some other way. So it's this is so the Dharma that we're learning about here is about dukkha, is about releasing dukkha, the distress and dis-ease and dissatisfactoriness that we add to things. So somebody may have hurt us, or maybe even be continuing to hurt us in a way, in a kind of emotional way, right? And we can acknowledge that and still let go of the added resistance to things having turned out this way. And just, letting go of that sense of resistance to, like, that shouldn't be this way, it shouldn't have happened this way, it's not meant to be this way. That's what we switch off. We don't switch off our real emotions and sincere reactions to things, but we switch off that extra resistance. Because we're talking about how things got this way. So that resistance is utterly futile. It's all about, what came before this moment, which we can't do anything about. So letting go of desire for things to be other than how they are. And that's where, you might use a term like acceptance or forgiveness or whatever, but when we turn off that extra dukkha, what we get is more clarity, more peace of mind, more open-mindedness, the ability to see the other person for who they really are, as opposed to our own, story or expectations or hurts. Oftentimes it ends up we're able to see more about how they might have ended up acting the way they did, and it becomes less personal, right? So I will leave it there for that little section on recognizing and releasing dukkha within our relationships. So, anyone want to say anything? Cedar.
So last decade or so, my mother and I have really been working on our relationship, and now I'm in her home of recent months, and we had these times prior to where we would go to the coast, and then we'd kind of get into these heated discussions, let's say. And part of that was due to the fact that she was wanting more than I to rehash a lot of stuff that happened in my childhood. And then there was also factors like, I know that she's had memory lapse due to a seizure, and I didn't really want to continue rehashing that. I was healed enough within myself. And so I just wanted to kind of lay that to rest and move forward. And part of what helped me was to say, if we knew how to do better, then we would have. based on the fact that in general we love each other versus we weren't trying to commit violence toward each other. So that was one factor. Let's see if I can remember the other. And I think just our willingness to have conversations with each other when things come up. Oh, and recently, so I noticed a pattern that I'd never seen before, that she was getting frustrated with something in her life. And then that energy was just coming forward to me because she didn't know where to put it, basically. And I was just noticing, oh, this is energy about why that came toward me when I was a child. She didn't know what to do with it. So there are things that are showing up that I can acknowledge as an adult and then say, hey, don't throw that energy towards me. I know you're frustrated, but it's not mine to take on. So maybe that's helpful.
Making sure. I'm aspirational about this. I want to get better at it. I feel a lot of guilt about setting boundaries with a family member who is got a lot of really difficult karma that is unraveling at the end of her life. And I feel like if I were a really good Buddhist, I would, be in, it may be true. This may be true that I would be in contact with her and I would bear some of that. Like, Cedar, I'm glad you brought it up. I would bear some of that. I would listen. I would call and I would talk and I would listen and I would do because she's very needy, and I would fill that role because it's what she needs. And then the other way to go would be keep the boundary, not 100%, but it's like, yeah, I will have limited, written, I'll have emails, but I'm not gonna call her. So that's kind of where I am with that. And I think, well, is that right or not? I don't know. It's probably not right, which is why I feel guilty about it. But anyway, that I aspire to what you describe.
Yeah, and I think you know what I'm thinking of, like I was saying, the ongoing question of boundaries. Buddhism doesn't tell us too much about the details, right? It's like be thoughtful, be mindful, and it can be a moving target, but there can also be, which I'm guessing that you are also working on, is like there can be, what is the internal state of our heart as we are having to deal with somebody? Do we, is there a sense of kind of resentment? Why are they doing this to us, or why they're being so, I don't know, whatever, right? But that sense of it just, there can be an acceptance of the way that things are. Just like I say in Zazen, where you can always just kind of expand the container, so that there can be a kind of spiritual acceptance of the whole picture, right? Of like, kind of crazy mother-in-law, your own limited capacity, the whole thing, in a way, can be something that we just accept and not waste too much time just, wishing it were not so. Looks like Jinryu is.
I'm sorry if I'm repeating you because this talk is wonderful and I'm sitting back there listening, but it conjures up, all the memories. And then am I listening to my memories or am I listening to you? And so, but the commentary has also been excellent. And one of the things I have had to do is get rid of these old ideas that people state as truth, which are not necessarily true. Big brothers should be good to their little sisters. Not so. And as some people in here know, and as you know, of course, I have a very difficult relationship with both of my brothers, perhaps especially my oldest one. And I have had, my reaction has been to complete distance myself. And in the past, 6, 8, 10, 15 years ago, if I were to tell people about this, they would say, "Oh, that's so sad." Well, it's not sad. If you knew him, you wouldn't like him either. And you wouldn't want to be in the same room with him either. I mean, we have to, I have had to get rid of those things. Christmas is about family. Thanksgiving is about family. Well, my Christmas and my Thanksgiving are very peaceful and quiet. That's one of the things I was thinking of. And then there was something else. Gosh, I can't remember it. I guess that'll have to be it. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Like I was like, in any given situation that's causing us distress, what can we let go of? Can't some things we can't let go of. And that's just not, that's not something that we can, but we can let go of a story, right? About like, I've been carrying around a story that, siblings should be close. Siblings and they shared a childhood and they were friends when they were children and they should be close. But then you start to talk to people, like most of the time, that's not the case. That's not act people are like, I never talk to my siblings, Sometimes yes, sometimes no. All right. Well, I wanted to go on to the next section, but do you have a quick one, Jinryu?
I do. It's the second thing. And that was that, and this is hard to remember, but people, my brothers, they don't do things to me. They are just being who they are. And if I'm kind enough and generous enough, I can simply be quiet and allow them to be who they are. I'm not necessarily the object. The object is way out here somewhere, and sometimes I get hit, and sometimes I don't.
And, even if we are the object, sometimes it's like in there's a sense in which that also doesn't have anything to do with us. If we are trying to be as, if we're doing the best we can, if we're trying to be kind and patient, even if we make mistakes, right? Like, then if somebody really does kind of target us and whatever, then that's not. Theoretically, anyway, we can let go of identifying with that. All right, so the one last, I'll just get to one more. This is a good one. Trying to control others, or at least wishing that we could. So, we may not think of this as like we may end up being conscious that we're okay, I just wish I could control their behavior. But essentially, whenever we're stressing out about the behavior of a family member, a partner, wishing they would behave otherwise, we're either in some ways going to be trying to control their behavior or wishing that we could. We might call it influence or whatever, but right, but we kind of wish we could change them. And sometimes there are very good reasons for this, right? I mean, children, you're trying to parent children. People may have negative patterns,
They may be hurting others, they may be hurting themselves, they may be hurting you, they may be struggling with addictions or not taking care of themselves or not making healthy choices. And of course, I mean, most of the time when we wish that our family member would act differently, it's not so objectively kind of on their behalf, right? It's more about like, we just wish they'd call more often, or they would load the dishwasher differently, right? Like, usually our wishes for people to be different, it's just not, it's not really about so much their well-being or anything like that, right? Just wish that my husband was more talkative and he was the kind of person when I came home and we could say, "How was your day, honey?" And we'd talk about our days. He's not, but I kind of wish that he was. So, like, how caught up am I in that desire for it to be different? So, but even if we keep just the kind of the legitimate concerns about somebody, we might think, of course, that it's right to try and influence another person's thinking or behavior. And we sometimes imagine that if we could just find the right approach, we could be brave enough to speak up, or if we could just communicate our viewpoint or I, you know, the communicate in the right way so the person understood it, or if we were strong enough to insist. Or if we had the courage to push the boundaries a little bit, or if we were, loving enough to be persuasive, just like there's a little if only something, then I could get this person to change. Then our relationship would be different, or this person's life would look a lot different. Then our relationship with the person would be become how we want it to be. Or that person's life would be become how we envision it could be. But think of some way you would like a person close to you to change, whether you communicate or act on that or not. Just doesn't have to be big, or grand, something small or going to be big. Now express that to yourself as a wish based entirely in goodwill, having nothing to do with you or any of your emotions. Just like we do in metta practice, may you be free from fear and anxiety. May you be at ease. May you find a way to be released from your addiction to nicotine. May you find your way through spiritually to end your self-destructive behaviors. Try to phrase it positively, right? As opposed to, may you stop. May you stop doing that creepy thing, right? But may you find the security and ease that would allow you to be kind. So this is the Bodhisattva's wish for beings. And we can sincerely wish for the behavior of people around us to change. And sometimes when their behavior affects us, we have to admit there's some self-interest. And like we were saying, boundaries may be necessary, requests. But what's different is when we take the approach of not trying to control, of seeing beings as having their own autonomy, their own path, that when we have this wish for them. And we need to maybe, in association, make some kind of request or some put down some kind of boundary. That boundary or that request is entirely about us. It has not it has nothing to do with them. You know, so if we do, for example, have somebody who just really wants to call us all the time and dump their misery on us, you know, we can wish that they find the peace, you know, that they somehow find in and like this is where I kind of like that imagery of rebirth, even if you don't literally believe it, right? In this life or the next, that you find the spiritual ease, you know, that lets you be at peace. And given that's not the case right now, I need this space, as opposed to you need to stop doing something, right? I recognize I need this space or I need this thing, and we can request it. So theoretically, anyway, this can be free from the stickiness of self-attachment. We have often, in terms of family, attached these people to our sense of self. Their behavior, their future, their suffering, their happiness is entangled with our own sense of self in our minds. We, you know, there's love and altruism mixed in there too, but some of it is, right, like we might have a child who's struggling and not, you know, making it quite a success of their life. And part of it may be just, you know, where we really are concerned and we want the best for them. But a little part of it too can be my child is suffering, right? Like my child isn't being successful. And it's an extension of like somehow their failure is your failure. So obviously that is not that kind of thing's not very helpful, right? That level of entanglement, but there can be that sincere wish. That willingness to be supportive, and yet also that lack of self-attachment. We can be interdependent in the true sense without being entangled, right? We can recognize that our family members are part of ourself. The self is like there's no clear boundary to it. Right? Part of who we are is our relationships and all of that. And when we lose someone, we lose part of ourself, and it's very disorienting and painful. But that kind of interdependence, in a way, isn't the same thing as this kind of self-entanglement, right? We're not telling a story about a self necessarily when we recognize our interdependence. So I'll leave that. We have a few minutes left to chat about it. If anybody has any thoughts about trying to change other people's behaviors. Oh, just
Well,
waiting. Just
Domhnaill,
wait.
thank you
Yeah, go
for this
ahead.
talk.
Yeah.
I think for people who are sometimes in a service profession, the wider scope of that, helping people, is to mentally, with some persons, wear a vest so that their insecurities aren't, you're keeping your, I guess you'd call that your own boundary. And I know when I first started sitting, I thought, oh, that seems disingenuous to think I could get rid of this old fear. And then a couple years into sitting, I thought, oh my goodness, I didn't even know. It was like a piece of apparel I no longer needed to wear. And, so
As a writer, I say never say never, and avoid the word always, because it's really, we don't need it. Thank you for.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Ruthann. Jessica.
Well, my immediate thought in response to what about changing others is good luck with that. And I've really, and I used to try to do it. It's kind of pointless. And these days I really focus on my own response and how do I want to respond in a way that would be helpful to myself and to that other person. Because really trying to change other people just does not work.
It's hard to give up that hope, though. Oh.
I would say this, I do have a question.
Yeah.
Well, there's a saying that Brad Warner said, and the best way to help somebody is to help yourself by being a better person for that person. I forgot how it went, but I could save all sentient beings from myself. That's what Brad Warner said that.
Yeah, that I've heard that too, that the Bodhisattva vow to free all beings, you could say, I'm going to start with freeing all beings from me, from my own, delusions and neediness and what have you, and in a way, like, as we all know from experience, the wisest and most compassionate responses are almost always those that just arise naturally, right? They're not like, I have an idea about what would be a good thing, and then I'm going to set about and adopt an agenda and make that happen. It's really more of a natural thing. Like, sometimes we can say things that influence people, but it's a rare opportunity. It's waiting, and we just say some ask some gentle question or something like that, and that is much more likely to be able to arise when we've dealt with our own stuff and we're not all caught up on our own misery. So I moved out to Oregon to go to college. So when I was 18, I'm now 54 and I've spent all my life in Oregon. And my family is still all right here in Minnesota. I'm the only one who's left on a permanent basis. So I come back and I'm like, oh, there's all of a sudden there's all this family. And they're very nice people. I'm fortunate. I have a very nice family. But I've really been able to watch over the years. Okay, I go home and like, well, how am I when I am here? What do I get pulled into? How do I see myself? And a lot of time, certainly for a long time, there was kind of a sense of disconnect between Oregon and Minnesota, right? Minnesota, I was whatever. I was a wildlife biologist, and then I was a Zen monk, and then I'm a Zen teacher, and whatever. And in Minnesota, I'm just like, I'm Dawn. I'm just like, I have a, I'm a, certain way that I'm seen by everybody and certain things that I do, and it felt very small and limited. But over the years, just kind of working through things, letting go of things, having a more fluid sense of self. Obviously, I feel different when I'm here, but there's more, it doesn't feel like a different universe, It feels more like, oh, okay. So it's been interesting to watch that change in relationship to family. And I think if you might be surrounded by family throughout the course of your practice, you might not necessarily notice the changes. But I come home once or twice a year, and then I really kind of see those differences. So, yeah, that pretty much brings us to the end.
So thank you all for being here. Abiding in this ephemeral world, like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna.